Whilst we're waiting, what we'll do, Glenn, is the reference to Michael Mann's New Climate War. We'll put that in the useful links page, and also probably the crying Indian advert, which sounds absolutely brilliant. But if I might just ask you a question, you mentioned something. You didn't want to patronise us, but you can patronise me because you mentioned an ology, and I thought you said phenology or something. I didn't quite catch it, and I don't know what the hell you mean. If you could just explain that.
Yeah, sure. I hope you can hear me now. Phenology is spelt with a PH at the beginning, phenology, right. Phenology. And what it describes is, I mean, forgive me, as I said earlier, I'm a sculptor, I'm not a botanist, but I've got a keen interest in wildlife. But what it is, it's the order in which things happen for an organism, if you like. So if a life cycle of a particular, I don't know, moth or something means that around February the 28th, the moth emerges, and then around March it sort of starts its sort of activities, and the caterpillar emerges in sort of April or something. That usually happens at a fairly fixed time in any one place and in any one year. An example of that might be where I live now. Today, I heard the first cuckoo that I've ever heard. Well, not that I've ever heard, but this year. I heard the first cuckoo. I also saw the first orange-tipped butterfly, and that butterfly coincides with the emergence of a plant called Cardamine pratensis. The common name is lady's smock, which you will be seeing now. It's a little tiny sort of lilac-y purple pinky flower, and also called the cuckoo flower. So it's interesting because the common name of that plant, the cuckoo flower, would suggest that it also coincides with the arrival of the cuckoo, you see. So what I'm saying here is that, so phenology is these things happen, tend to happen in particular places at particular times. So fish will go up rivers at certain times of the year and so on and so forth. Now, yeah. If part of that cycle or pattern, I should say, changes, it will affect the organism. So if that caterpillar ceases to emerge, or let's say it emerges earlier, then the bird that would have relied on that caterpillar to feed its young can no longer get it. So that bird will die out or become fewer. That's basically what phenology is.
Interconnectivity, okay. Thank you for that clarification. Well, we don't seem to have anybody in the speaking. Maybe you've answered everybody's questions.
Now, I bored them to death, I expect. They probably think, oh, can I sign off now? I could do with a pint.
Well... Nick, comrade Sampez has obviously got resilient most, so if you come in, please, now, comrade Sampez.
Hi, Glenn. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you. I can.
Thanks for the talk. Very interesting. Quite positive in this less than positive world. I've got a couple of points. The first one, not actually totally related to ecology and the environment, but you talked about the government mentioning that HS2 is going to produce loads of jobs. So sod the environment. In actual fact, it's going to take 60 years for them to generate, to cover just 42% of the capital costs for the project, based on the current business plan. So it looks like, the taxpayer is going to end up paying for this project for the next 100 years. The only people who are going to make any money out of this are the bankers through loans and the profits they're going to make on providing those loans for this project. It's all about generating money for the rich, and that's why it's happening. Well...
I wouldn't argue with you, Nick. I think you're absolutely right. And I sort of use that as an example, but yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. Incidentally, on that subject of, making money for the rich, can I suggest another book to any of you guys that may not have come across it? In fact, this book is called Talking to My Daughter by the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis. I don't know if any... Do you know that one?
I do very well. I've read quite a few of Yanis's books. That's an exceptionally good. It's easy to read. It's quite light-hearted. In fact, I've read a few of his books, and to me, that's the best one that Yanis has written. So
yeah, the reason I mentioned it is because I'm really not great with sort of glaze over with anything that deals with that sort of depth of economy. But it, as you rightly say, it is extremely easy to read, and you know, whether one. Obviously, not all, everyone that writes in these ways, you know, shares our, if you like, the opinions at the end of the, you know, how one might solve these things. But I do think it's a very, very good read that, in terms of, you know, explaining how capitalism has turned out as it has.
I've got another question, but I'll wait for the others to chip in.
Okay, Nick, put yourself back in the queue, and I'll get you. Brian, have you got a question or contribution? Brian Johnson,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, just a little backup as well in regards to phenology. Locally, I belong to the local environmental group, and they had organized a bat watch because it's well known that. There's a wildlife corridor running through the village for a number of miles. And along this wildlife corridor, every year it was noticeable the bats were coming out. And we went down to the project and mounted a bat watch during the night, collected the moths and all the rest of it, and finding out what moths the bats were eaten, et cetera, et cetera. And then we left it, and we went back then about 6 weeks later, right? And you would have thought that the moths would still be about, but apparently they wasn't. They had been in the years past, right? But now they haven't. Now, the local bat expert, right, and that's quote-unquote, suggested if this continues, what will occur is the bat population will crumble, right? Because they just haven't got the feed, right? And we can expect less bats around, right? Because there's less insects as well. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I'll take another question next. Glenn. So let's see if we can gather some comments and that you can deal with collectively. I'll take Mike Foster then, please.
Cheers. Yeah, thanks. Good evening. And thanks very much for the talk, Glenn. Yeah, that was really clearly and persuasively put and brought to life as well by the slides. Really enjoyed that. I'll listen to it again once the audio uploads. Been put on the website. A couple of quick points, if I may. And one of my bugbears, which I'll which I'll get off my chest, is people paving over front gardens with driveways. I don't know if this sort of makes me qualify as a sort of grumpy old man for it really getting to me, but I think the thing with that is it. you know, obviously by wiping out a front garden, that's a bit of greenery that's gone. But of course, to replace it with a driveway for a car, you know, that sort of stamping on sort of green spaces in quite a brutal way. And of course, I think that contributes to flooding as well, doesn't it? If you've got a street with lots of paved over driveways. So yeah, that's just something that gets to me. I think I've sort of brought up in conversation a couple of times myself to try and get people to think. But I suppose my other main point, more important one maybe, is that it has been in the news about America accelerating their targets for climate, for reducing emissions. And looking at the story again, that they're basing it on data from, I think, about 15 years ago. So they're saying we're going to reduce emissions by, I think, 50-odd%, and you know, on the face of it, that sounds quite good within a short time scale. But of course, it's based on a benchmark which has long gone. You know, the whatever carbon we were pumping out 15 years ago is less than now. So it's that ambition's not as ambitious as they like us to think. So yeah, Glenn, I was just wondering what your thoughts are on those kinds of targets which are set by states and how realistic or how sort of propagandistic they are. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks for those questions. Well, your first issue about the front gardens and the parking, I actually had a slide of this years and years ago that I used to show to when I was giving talks to these sort of various, I don't know, Rotary clubs and women's institutes and various other things. And I had to be honest with you. I was at a point in if you like, my sort of environmental approach where I was a bit annoying. I think I tended to take this sort of, you know, this, you know, what I've just complained about. In fact, I said, you know, this is your problem. You're doing this, you know, which I've long since dropped because I think it turns people off. I think, you know, I think what we need to do is really take a positive approach and look at all the wonderful good things that would come out of the society that we want. But your point is interesting because you're absolutely right. I mean, it is often brought up as an issue because it causes, it individually doesn't cause flooding, but it means that gardens don't take up the rainfall and so on. And so all the water washes into land drains and so on and so forth. Yeah, and that is an issue. But I think a slightly bigger issue, interestingly, is that when that person lives in that house is going to work every day and they're sort of, you know, they're possibly not feeling very good about themselves. They're, you know, maybe they've got crap prospects or whatever it is. They're trying to say something about them is a bit different. And so what you'll find on those little paved areas, they'll park their car and it'll be something that they seen on an advert that says if you buy this car you're going to be a damn sight better than your next door neighbor. I know that sounds terribly sort of harsh and cynical, but I suspect that's probably what it's all about. It's having somewhere to park this big showy car, you know. I think that's what it is. But your main point, sorry, and the American targets, I haven't read that yet, Mike. Well, I've heard about it on the news, but I haven't read anything about it in detail yet. But I think the big problem is you've got, I think it used to be, there's a name for this. It's some of you will know this, I'm sure. Perhaps all of you will. I think it's called something game something. It's when one country daren't do anything for fear of the other one not doing it. So you'll stop good things happening. So say, for instance, if country A said, right, we're going to get rid of all our nuclear warheads. They won't do that because they're rather worried that if both countries promise it, maybe the other country won't do it. And I think that America is probably a terrible example in a way of a country that's likely to do anything good, frankly, in terms of fossil fuels. I mean, they're wedded to them. They really are. And also what is sadly not being spoken of is this constant talk of growth, but not of talking using less energy. That's because it is assumed by most people, I think, that, you know, growth is a good thing. Growing the economy is a good thing. And all that dictates use of more and more and more fuel of some sort. And incidentally, I sent Paddy a link and Adam a link recently, and you guys might want to look at this on YouTube. It's a very recent thing. It's a debate between, interestingly, Brian Eno, the musician, Naomi Klein, Yanis Varoufakis, I never know what the V and the F are the right way around or not. But if you type in that on YouTube, and there's an American economist, that's a pretty interesting debate. And that deals with some of your points, Mike. But can I just actually, forgive me, I'm just turning my phone on because I've got something I wanted to tell you about America on here that I didn't say. So it might be a little bit out of sync with the talk, but as Mike's brought up America, I just wanted to read this to you. It's a passage from Michael Mann's book, and he's dealing with the fact of economy being more important than people. So I think, you know, this is one of the things, and if it's more important than people, then you can bet your bottom dollar it's going to be more important than the environment. I'll read this as it's written in the book, and it's dealing with the coronavirus, and he's talking about Republicans versus the Democrats. a quote, conservative coronavirus denial turned ever more deadly as a coordinated effort emerged among Republican politicians and talking heads to convince the elderly to, in inverted commas, take one for the team. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said on Fox News that grandparents should be willing to die to save the economy for their grandchildren. Conservatives doubled down on this talking point, with other leading personalities like Fox News' Brit Hume arguing that it was an entirely reasonable viewpoint for the elderly to risk their lives to help the stock market. I kind of rest my case. Can you see that? I mean, it is believed by Americans that, you know, people should die to save the economy. Okay, and that's probably the wrong answer for you, Mike, but there we are. I did.
Okay, thank you. That's a corker. Okay, got Comrade Carter next, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that really interesting talk, and it plunged me into the abyss of misery, but then raised me up to some beautiful heights. So it was a very widespread talk. There's just a few points that it brought to mind. I was listening to a debate in the House of Commons last year sometime, and one of these so well-educated, well-known people stood up and said, it's all right about ancient woodland because we can replant it. And I knew that was the height of stupidity, but of course they aren't allowed to interrupt each other or at least only quietly. They can't stand up and debate in a good manner. And also, yes, for the explanation of phenology, because I knew what it was describing, but I didn't know there was a word for it. So that was really interesting. And another thing that I think that you, well, so much you touched on, but there's so many people have the answers to the problems, like in this paving over of front gardens. In the gardening world, it's been sort of really pushed now that people shouldn't pave over their drives. Or if they do, they should do it in such a way that permeable material is put down so the water can drain through, and they should be planting things in between where the tires go so that there's a certain amount of greenery growing in the garden. And the other thing, near where I live is a bluebell wood, a beautiful bluebell wood. And when the bluebells come into flower, it's sort of in the local newspaper, and there are hundreds of people flock there for the 3 weeks or so that the bluebells are in flower. So a lot of things are valued, but nobody links them up, do they? They don't talk to each other about these things and what you've described about the destruction of them, of one aspect of a plant or an animal. I think that's all I could say for the minute. But anyway, thank you very much for that.
Can I come back on that, Paddy? Quick.
Let's take the next. Is that okay with you? Yeah. Okay. I'm the chairman. I'll take Doogie next. McClellan.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for a very interesting talk. I think we've got to admit that people in the West and other countries that have a higher standard of living, you know, they're bought off like golden chains or whatever, you know. They have to work until they're 65 or 66 or 70, but, you know, they buy into the capitalist system. And the trouble with capitalism is every country wants to increase their GDP by 3%, or China maybe by about 10%. And it's unsustainable, you know. You can't do that. But one of the side effects of that kind of growth is that people are slightly better off as things go on, unless there's a recession or whatever, and then they're worse off, or, you know, they'll lose their job, they'll lose their house or whatever. So, I think we have to talk to workers and say it's just unsustainable the way capitalism operates, you know, the economics of the madhouse, right? You know, and it causes wars, it causes problems. Other countries, you know, they cut back on aid to foreign countries because they're having to pay for the coronavirus crisis or whatever. So, I mean, coronavirus is a case in point. I mean, people, most people over 60, about 95%, have taken the vaccine, you know. And it was a scientific achievement to develop these vaccines to stop people dying, right? You know. But you've got people in denial of that, and you've got misinformation about that, really. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm going on, but I think capitalism's unsustainable, and that's one of the things we've got to say to people.
Okay, thanks,
Tugger.
Do you
want
to come back in now?
Is that me, Paddy?
Yeah, do you want to come back in?
But forgive me, the lady's first name, I didn't catch.
Janet.
Janet, okay. Well, Janet mentioned the ancient woodland. With the socialist sort of hat on, I care passionately. I work with trees a lot, but I never want to forget the fact that, you know, that's just one symptom. You know, the way the environment is treated is one symptom, and that we mustn't forget that. You know, we could talk about individual woodlands, but the moment you do that, you're focusing in on one very small thing. All these problems, if you like, in a socialist society they just wouldn't exist. I mean, I think that you'd have the legacy of capitalism to deal with, obviously, but we know for a fact that nature recovers astonishingly quickly. That said, Janet's point about the ancient woodland and these companies that say they're just going to replace them, you can't replace ancient woodland. Basically, these small trees that they plant, they're usually called 1+1s, or they're whips, or they're something like that. And you see them going these regimental lines with these plastic tubes around them. And the plastic tubes create a microclimate, and they're alleged to make the tree help the tree grow quickly. I've seen them fail time and time again. But more to the point, they fail not so much because they're going to die anyway, but they don't normally, these companies, build in proper maintenance contracts for them. So they're not really looked after. So once they've done their bit and they tick the box, they're on to the next development. And as I said earlier, no one cares. It's sort of done and dusted then. The woodland's gone, they got the railway in, and they obfuscate, and it all doesn't happen. So, but more to the point, even if those young trees survived, more often than not, they're not local provenance, so they would have been brought in from often Holland or somewhere like that. And we all know what happens when things are brought over from abroad. We've had recently the ash dieback. And on that subject, incidentally, a friend of mine, a chap called Ray Woods, who used to work for Plant Life, is one of the country's leading lichenologists. He told the government that if they brought these plants in, from Holland, these diseased ash trees, it will cause absolute havoc. And he was right. But the reason they brought them in is because the nurseries were trying to grow ash and guess the demand of these trees, but they couldn't. And the government had some cockeyed grant scheme in that was in chaos. So what the nurseries used to do was not, you know, they try their best, and then they'd top up their stocks with this stuff from Holland. So therefore, we pretty much decimated one of our most common, arguably the most common, I think, other than hawthorn, decimated one of our most common native species. And it's that, again, forgive me going on, Janet, here a bit, but that comes back to the same issue again, because that will cost the country £15 billion to sort the ash problem out, which everyone will probably read at first sight and throw up their hands and horror and think that's awful. Actually, it isn't awful, because it makes work for tree surgeons, contractors, and heaven knows who else. So it's one of these weird things in capitalism where a tragedy becomes an opportunity, rather like, as I was saying early, war leads to opportunities for arms dealers and so on. Anyway, Janet, sorry, I went off a tangent. But the bluebell wood you mentioned, how people come to see that, this is something that I think is interesting, because, you know, we are not the only species on the planet. We kind of like to think we are as humans at the moment. I say we, I'm not talking about you guys. I mean, there's a general assumption that the human creature is unbelievably important. But in reality, we share the planet with an awful lot of other creatures. And what we perhaps don't realize is the importance not only of their existence in our lives. And we've all heard about that research from Germany that talks about how important insects are, which were the things that in the past you'd annoyingly wipe off your windscreen, and now they're declining. But, you know, these things are part of a web that involves us too. But Janet was saying about people coming to look at a bluebell ward. Now, if you take capitalism as 60% or so, it is said, of people in capitalism work within an economic job. So they'll be dealing with banking, insurance, checkouts, any number of things that involve finance, accountancy, you name it, banking, a whole lot. Those jobs would cease to exist. So imagine the time that would be available on your hands to sort of contribute to society, to work, but also to be able to engage with that bluebell wood, to really enjoy it. And it's utterly beautiful. And these things, a lot of people just don't have time. But what the COVID thing threw up, of course, was people did. And Doug kind of referred to this in his comment too, because he was saying that, you know, people slog away all their lives and they get home, they're so knackered, you know, they can't really do much else. So, the companies they work for screw every last bit of energy they can out of them. And so, you know, they may do a little bit, but they're knackered, they go to bed and get up the next day. I know this for a fact, because not only have I done it, but my daughter's doing it now. She works in a care home. They work her 12 hours a day. She gets 20 minutes for a break, and they expect her not only that to do 5 days, but often do whole weekends as well. And she's just knackered when she gets in. That's her working life. So Doug was right. And I mean, therefore, people have no time. But in socialism, you would. This is the wonderful thing about that prospect. You could write off masses of useless jobs, and suddenly you think life would be, it would be so astonishingly amazing, because, you know, not only would you be doing work that was valuable for the community, you feel good about yourself, you'd be producing great things, you feel good about other people, there'd be no sort of, you know, I've got a better car than you, there'd be a car if you want to use it, drive it, that's fine. But no one says, look at me in this car, they're just using it to get from A to B. And the whole thing, you know, all these bluebells could be appreciated. Sorry, I don't want to go off on one there, Janet, but
you just did. Never mind. Okay, comrade Freddie Edwards, please.
Yes, evening, Glenn. It's nice to hear you again. You might recall we met in Doncaster a couple of so years ago when you came up to speak on behalf of the party. And at that time, I told you that not so much in my previous life, but you know what I mean, but some 30 years back, I was the local authority's horticultural officer, so can identify readily with what you say, and perhaps stayed in that, but my trade union activities took me off in another direction and into another career. Then, with the point I'm trying to get at here, though, is that in what you say, you know, for example, when Dutch elm disease, though, hit the country, I was still engaged in arboricultural work at that time. And I know we were having to take down elm trees one after the other to, and even in some cases inject perhaps particularly good specimens in the hope that we may be able to survive them. And I can also identify with this ash dieback that a few years back became prevalent. But the point I'm trying to get at here is that what positives can you think, though, that we can take out of, if any, what positives do you think we can take out of the way workers in general, though, do tend and can do get together to try and help preserve the planet? As well, you know, that I've mentioned before on this forum, the great amount of valuable work that that volunteers do. I mean, for example, a couple of weeks ago, I was out at a place called Bempton Cliffs. Some of you may or may not have heard of it. It's between Scarborough and Bridlington, and the Gannets and the Kittiwakes, so on and so forth, and puffins are flocking there again. And when I got talking to the warden that was on site, he was saying that more and more people And now, from his point of view, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with it, are becoming more and more conscious about the world in which we live. And that, in fact, even today, I was out in a place not too far from where I live, in a forest wooded area, which is substantially serviced by volunteers. Volunteers are coming along and looking after the woodland, looking after the lake, etc. So, but can you see any positives in increase, mindful that you're still actively engaged in the occupation? Do you see any positives as to the way that we are reacting to it? Thank you.
Oh, hi, Freddie. I do remember you. Yeah, indeed. In fact, you reminded me about you being an ARB officer, but you weren't covered in sawdust like most of us were. But I think that's because we tended to be a bit nervous of our ARB officers, us contractors, you know, because they came along and checked your work. But in answer to your questions, you know, working people do volunteer, as you rightly say. And so I think a really, really positive thing that can come out of this sort of thing, I'm unhappy about charitable work, as I call it, because I think there are, what it does demonstrate is there's some wonderful, caring people who are prepared to give up their time free of charge to do wonderful things. So it does kind of dispel the myth that, you know, the selfish gene, in my view. And I think it does it pretty well. So it does show that human beings do care about each other. It's clear to see. I think the sad thing is about charitable work, of course, is that it gets the government off the hook, and indeed world governments off the hook. But coming back to your thing, the positive thing. Yeah, I mean, there's so much positivity and positive stuff to be gained from this sort of work. Now, you call it volunteers, but in socialism, the word volunteer wouldn't exist either. People would work together for a common good. And I did mention earlier on, incidentally, Yanis Varoufakis's book, and he does deal with this at the very beginning of the book, Freddie. And so that's why it might be worth reading that book. It's called Talking to My Daughter, just as a reminder there. But what he says in the beginning of the book, he's talking to he kicks off with this conversation with his daughter, and what he's saying in it is that you have these two ways of doing something. So you have what's known as an experiential way of doing something. So say someone says to you, he has examples, but I'll give you another one. Say someone says, oh, blimey, you know, my car's packed up. Will you come and rings you up? Can you come and pick me up? And you go out. So Freddie gets into his car, drives through the rain and 20 miles to go and pick his mate up. That's an experiential thing. And you feel good about it, and he feels good because you've helped him. No money's changed hands. It's just a good feeling. But if your mate rang you up and said, look, my car's packed up, I'll give you five if you come and pick me up, the whole relationship changes. Now, I've given a pretty poor example there, but if you read that book, he goes into that sort of thing in some depth. So where I'm going with that, Freddie, is that if you're volunteering for work, you're going along with no thought of lining your pocket with anything. You're engaging with people in a way that is not competitive. You're doing great stuff. You're using energy. You're out in the fresh air. I mean, there's any number of things that are good about that. And you're doing something that's improving somebody's environment and indeed your own environment. So that's all great. It makes people feel good. But socialism would be like that all the time. That's how it would be. And which is, again, to me, a brilliant selling point for socialism. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. We've got Moggy coming up next.
Hello. Just a couple of little comments. Well, a good news story and a not so good news story. 5 years ago, we had a major earthquake. It was a 8.4, which, of course, would wipe most cities off the planet. But because we build for earthquakes, most of the city survived it. But what has happened was one of the beaches in the around the Wellington Harbour had come up by several feet. And so it meant that the sea was a lot further back than what it used to be. And there are little birds, I think they're dotterels, that were nesting on the beach. So now their nests are much further away from the sea than what they used to be, which meant that they were now exposed to various dangers that they didn't have before. But the whole community out there is protecting these birds. They're all doing what they can to keep dogs off the beach and look after these little birds, because the birds have now got to adapt to the fact that the sea is not where it was before. So that's one story. But another one, which just comes down to greed, I guess, it was on the news last night, that dairy farms, which have now got so big in New Zealand that they've become a problem. They weren't a problem years ago, but now the dairy farms have got so big that all the cow poo is getting washed into the rivers. The rivers are getting polluted because we've just got too many cows. Also, cows give off a lot of gas, which is affecting, affecting the environment if you've got too many cows in one area. But what they're doing now is they can put a little implant in the cow's ear, and the cows can now walk themselves along to the milking shed at a certain time every morning. The farmer doesn't even have to send his dog out to round these cows up and bring them to the milking shed. This little implant will whistle them or something, and they know which direction to go. So the farmer can be overseas, and these cows will just turn up at the milking shed at the appointed time. All they've got to do now is teach the cows to milk themselves, and they won't need anyone to operate the milking machinery or anything. And so that was big news on the news last night, and I thought, well, what a shame. Wouldn't it be better if we just get rid of some of the cows? So anyway, that's all I've got to say.
Right, thanks, Moggy. If I could just make a comment, this thing about intensive farming, of course, is going on all. I've seen this in South America. There's a river called the Santa Lucia in Uruguay, which is the main is the main source of drinking water, Montevideo, and upstream from that, they've got a lot of. And they're now starting to get algal bloom in the river and in the river plate. So it's the same sort of thing is occurring in Brittany. It's been going on for absolutely 30, 40 years. We've got intensive pig farm. You've got algal in a major bay in Afghanistan. It's the exact name. So this is the sort of thing that's occurring across the planet. If I could just make, I'll come to Nick in a minute, but just make one slight point with Chair's privilege, if you don't mind. You were talking about people's attitudes towards him. I wonder if you see something positive in what's occurred today in the UK, whereby the people from the Extinction Rebellion who are on trial for, I'm not sure what, presumably breaches of the peace or attacks against property, the jury in that case has ignored the judge's instruction to to find them guilty and find them not guilty. So to me, this is at least a slight indication of the way that people's attitudes can change. I don't know if you want to say something about that, or do you want to take Nick?
Steve, is that addressed to me or Nick?
No, that was addressed to you.
Oh, okay. Forgive me, I haven't seen that article. I'm aware of, a lot of what Extinction Rebellion get up to. Forgive me, I'm not sure I've seen that article, but from what you're saying, it sounds like, it may not be the step in exactly in a big step, but it's a good step when it shows the power that people have to do something different from what they're instructed to do, which sounds pretty hopeful to me, I must say, Steve, yeah.
Well, it's a very minor bright point. Okay, we'll take Nick, please.
Hi, a couple of things there. First off, I found a PDF of talking to my daughter and put it on the useful links. If people would like to read it. That's the link in the text channels. So you've got a PDF there of the book. Glenn, I had just a few questions. Well, three quick questions about this COP26 climate meeting that's coming up in November. First question is, why is Greta Thunberg threatening to boycott the meeting? And what do you think from the environment, or as an environmentalist, of the various government pronouncements on CO2 reduction? Do you believe it? Are these real? What were your thoughts on that? And then lastly, doesn't seem to be much of announcements about fossil fuels. I mean, I was thinking more about, things like the Alberta flats extraction, as mentioned by Naomi Klein in her book, This Changes Everything, which is quite shocking. That's a massive environmental catastrophe. No one seems to be talking about that. So, those are the questions I had. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Nick. A few things there. I haven't read up enough, and I don't feel able or qualified to answer your questions with any real authority, I'm afraid. I mean, Greta Thunberg is a sort of, everyone's now heard of her, and, you had Atterbury saying, she's wonderful and everything else. And I think she is a very good example of a young person that is, beginning to change things. I only hope that, I know she's been adopted by Extinction Rebellion. I kind of hope that she's not going to try, when she calls for system change, as indeed do Extinction Rebellion, that change is not a reform, but a real change. But, let's wait and see. I'm not holding my breath on it. And with referral to your talk on promises, I think probably if you read Michael Mann's book, the one I mentioned earlier, The New Climate War, he talks at great length about this, and far more qualified than I am to talk about that sort of thing. We all have opinions, but my opinion doesn't necessarily contain fact. I mean, I suspect the oil companies are so powerful within America and in the Middle East and Russia and so on, that they will call the shots. So, I mean, that is the problem. I think they're so powerful. It's all dealt with, incidentally, Nick, in Michael Mann's book. As for Naomi Klein, I must admit, I thought the tar sands in Alberta were being sort of, to some extent, shelved. I mean, they're dreadfully polluting. I think to take 6 barrels of fresh water to produce 1 barrel of oil out of tar sands. And I mean, it's, I don't know enough about that either, I'm afraid. I'd have to research it and come back to it. So that's not a great answer to your questions, Nick, I'm afraid. But I think Michael Mann covers a lot of that. And I suspect if anyone wanted to follow up your questions, the best thing to do would be to research it and look at some papers written on it. Sorry, I can't be of more help than that.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Comrade Cox, could you please mute yourself unless you're recognised by the chair? Mike, you need to unmute.
Did you call me?
Got you, please. Yes, please go ahead.
Oh, right, because I saw Freddie in there beforehand. Okay. Glenn, thank you very much. That's the longest talk I've heard on Discord, and it was most interesting. You covered a lot of stuff on there. I like the really good points you made about divide and rule, the way to get people to argue among themselves, and it's been going for, 5,000 years. But what you said tonight has kept me going, because I was getting very, I'm one of the doomsters. I can predict how quickly the planet will heat up and how quickly the ice sheets will melt. I follow on that. That's why I keep into it. But really, I was going to ask you, what do you think about this meeting in what I call the Cop-Out 26? Because it seems to me just politicians waffling on about how they're doing a little bit for the environment, a little bit to doing this, and keeping capitalism going. Now, we're not going to have any choice in talking to any of them, because the new fee bills that have been coming into effect seem to be designed to stop anything like Extinction Rebellion making any sort of points there and embarrassing Mr. Alexander Johnston. But what do you think we should approach? We're only going to be talking to the people who, the 30,000 who will be going there. Some of them mostly political activists. How do you think, how would you say we should appeal to them?
Mike, forgive me. I'm not sure if I'm alone in this, but
it was a little bit of a problem with his microphone, isn't it? I think what he wants to know is how do you think to approach the COP26? I think that's basically it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't hold out a great deal of hope, I'm afraid. I mean, a lot of the sort of viewpoints of people's lives that are being affected. And I think Mike mentioned this. Forgive me, I got very little of it because of the sound was so bad. But a similar point, and it's going off at a bit of a tangent. But when the war was going on in Afghanistan, or it might have been, forgive me, maybe it was Iran. I think it was Iran. Iraq, sorry. The then Secretary of State, I think it was Madeleine Albright, if I remember rightly, when she was informed of all the deaths of innocent children and civilians, her comment was quite simple. She said, it's a price worth paying. So I don't kind of hold out a great deal of hope, Mike. The system that we know doesn't, there'll be all sorts of sort of tweaks here and there and promises here and there, but we know they haven't been fulfilled. I mean, nothing's changing. The trajectories aren't changing. So, I'm afraid I really didn't pick up a great deal of what you were saying, but I think from what I can tell, I think I need to learn more about it and read up more about it and look more at it. If you would got a chance to email me the question, I'll do my best to answer better than the way I just have.
Okay, I think you basically took you've dealt with it. Let's just take Paddy. I'm sorry, Mike, because you're Mike Brown. I'm sorry, but your microphone is a bit hot.
Can you tell me when you don't hear me in the future, rather than let me go on?
So can you
hear that?
I hear that. I'm sorry. Okay.
Interrupt me when I go silent and tell me that, then I can see what I can do.
Okay, Mum.
If you don't mind. Thanks.
Try for future. Okay. We'll take Paddy next then.
I just wanted to pick up a couple of things that was said earlier. Nobody picked this up, so I thought I might mention it. When we were talking about, people were talking about HST, this new bloody train line that's going to sort of bulldoze a load of woodland, and it was mentioned, this was all taxpayers' money. Well, I mean, I feel incumbent upon someone to point out that, you know, the our view of this is that, you know, the burden of tax actually falls on the rich, on the owning class, not on workers. This isn't really taxpayers' money, even though it might seem like that. So the point of it here is that it's actually the rich who are investing in HST. It's the rich who are paying for HST. And the only reason the rich ever invest in anything is in the expectation of a future profit. Now, what that might be in the case of HST, I'm not really sure, but I suspect it's got to do with the expansion of London into a kind of super city. You know, that makes Birmingham a kind of cheap dormitory suburb of London. You know, with the so that all the London-based corporations have the benefit of a wider and a cheaper labour market. But that may be completely wrong. So sort of pursuing the idea of gainful investment, I think that's one of the things that a lot of capitalist economists are talking. Talking about, Mark Carney was banging on about this quite recently. In fact, he frequently does, former governor of the Bank of England, about, and you mentioned it as well, Glenn, several times, is that, you know, one person's threat is another person's opportunity. And of course, there's, you know, potentially hell of a lot of money to be made in, you know, so-called green technology. You know, even the oil companies are looking at this because, you know, there's obviously I don't know if we hit peak oil, but at some point, you know, oil is going to become sort of, uncompetitive compared to sort of green technologies. The price has been falling of things like solar cells for years now. I think it's fallen by about 80%. At the same time, efficiency has gone up. So that's kind of one encouraging thing. So, you know, the sort of upbeat capitalists are saying, you know, there's money in them that are green policies. And so that's one of the things, I think, driving these various sort of summit meetings. But also with the Paris Accord, and also, Glenn, you mentioned something about game theory. I think you were talking about game theory. Trump and, Donald Trump sort of defecting from the Paris Agreement is a sort of classic example of what happens in game theory. In particular, one manifestation of game theory, a famous one called Prisoner's Dilemma. I won't go into it, but basically, if it pays you to stab your colleague in the back because you do better out of it that way than if you cooperate, then you'll do that. You'll stab them in the back. But, and this is why, you know, traditionally, I think these kind of climate agreements haven't held, because it always pays the defector to opt out of the deal, because, you know, they don't have to then bear the costs of pollution control emissions control that the other countries have to bear, you know, who stay in the agreement. So, you know, up to now, defecting has been the sort of the preferred choice if you're brazen enough to do it. Trump was brazen enough, but I think what's different now, and here's where I want to be a bit upbeat, is that with the Paris Agreement, I mean, Biden climbed back on board the Paris Agreement, as we all knew he would, you know, on day one. China's on board now. That's something that's different. Before 2015, no, you couldn't get China on board these things. Russia's on board. All the big countries are. In fact, you know, Trump's America was practically the only major economy that had backed out of it. Now, the thing about the prisoner's dilemma, and here I just want to mention, you also mentioned, Glenn, you mentioned the selfish gene, as if, you know, this is, you know, the spirit of Thatcherism, the spirit of capitalism. this was from Richard Dawkins, and I've got to speak up. I've done this before, but I must speak up for this book. It isn't what you think. If you haven't read it, it's not what you think. It's all about altruism. It's the opposite of what the title suggests. If anybody hasn't read it, it's a it's a brilliant book, but it is all about altruism. It's not about being selfish. So that's, but in the pro, in that book, why it's such a fascinating book, and it's also the book that coined the word meme for the first time, that's now taken on a life of its own, or a meme of its own. But he also talks about evolutionary stable strategies. This will be something that's a bit closer to Glenn's heart. And the game theory comes into this because if you've got, if the, you know, this sort of prisoner's dilemma, if it only, if it pays you to stab your colleague in the back because you do better out of it, you know, that's fine if there's only one iteration of the game. But if there's two iterations of the game, of course, he's going to stab you back next go. So if it's an ongoing game, it actually doesn't pay you to stab your partner in the back because he'll retaliate. And this is the problem with ongoing games. So in one iteration, which is what the capitalists and the libertarians always go on about, in one iteration, yes, it pays to be selfish. It pays to stab the other guy in the back. But life isn't like that. Life is endless. Life is infinite iterations. And so is the climate. And what I want to suggest now is that what's motivating these countries now to actually try and make this Paris Agreement work is the knowledge that ultimately it's not they themselves that are going to retaliate against each other if they don't stick to this. It's the climate itself that's retaliating. It's nature itself that's retaliating. And we're going to be the losers. And so are the rich. You know, the rich aren't going to benefit if the world gets ruined for human beings. So that's my kind of hopeful take on it. But whether they'll actually accomplish anything, or whether, I know it's been said before that the capitalists will do something, but they'll leave it so long that by the time they finally decide to do something, it's going to be too late. I don't know. I still don't. I don't really expect capitalism to accomplish anything, but the debate is now so widespread amongst people around the world that hopefully now this is the point where we don't need to make the case against capitalism anymore. We can stop doing that now. We can just say, look at the state of the world. Look at the environmental arguments. If you're not interested in class, look at this. We don't actually need to make the case against capitalism anymore. All we need to do is say, look, socialism will work.
That was brilliant, Paddy. I couldn't. You know, next time I get asked to do a talk, I'll get you to do it for me. Erudite to the end. That was amazing. But I won't say anything because I think you said it all brilliantly. But you're right about the it's game theory. I was trying to think of the word, and the selfish gene. I think is you're right about that too. And of course, that was a kind of a misplaced concept. But I probably said it in the wrong way. But I guess it was to illustrate a point that, you know, some people do perceive people as inherently selfish and unpleasant. So I've got to leave it, I'm afraid, unless there's one quick question, because I've still got some stuff to do. But on a slightly amusing note, I just wanted to say that if anyone was listening in from the outside to our chat tonight, they would call us watermelons. Do you realize that? Because we're green on the outside and red on the inside, you see. That's the new term for anyone who tries to sort of get rid of capitalism with a green agenda.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting to know. Are you saying that you Glenn?
I don't have to sort of rush off immediately, but I've still got some stuff to do.
Okay, right. Can I just come in and make? I was in the queue, so I'd just like to make a comment that we've had the issue climate change for well over 50 years now, because the United Nations, maybe some people aren't aware of this, but the United Nations in the early 70s commissioned a study which was turned out to be called Only One Earth. And at that, they identified the problem with carbon emissions and so on and so forth, which would eventually lead to climate disaster. This is 50 years ago. The institutions of capitalism, the intergovernmental institutions of capitalism, have been unable to do anything about that, because we've now seen that the global climate has gone up by the order forecast by those people in 1972, and capitalism hasn't been able to deal with it. And in fact, there is a bit of a parallel that will be drawn in the next issue of the Standard between what's going on now and what's happened in the past with capitalists who plainly are always going to pursue their own profit, or their own potential for profit. In the past, in the 19th century, the British government was able to intervene to sort of mitigate the worst excesses of capitalist rapacity with the factory legislation and so on and so forth. They acted as we call them, the executive committee of the capitalist class in the UK. Unfortunately, at the moment, we've got this problem that capitalism has now burst the boundaries, any national boundaries, yet it doesn't have a government that acts as its executive committee. So I find this a little bit perturbing, that I don't think there's anything that is going to control these capitalists. Right, okay, that's that. I think Nick's got a question. Is it a question, Nick, or is it just to make sure we've seen that link?
A couple of points, really, on what...
Go ahead, please.
I'd like to offer an alternative, dare I say it. Paddy mentioned that the taxpayer is not going to be liable for HS2. Well, that's not according to various sites on the internet, including fullfact.org, which was published on the 1st of February 2021. The link I sent, well, it's a little bit out of date, but similar tune, but it certainly looks as though the taxpayer is going to ultimately face the costs of this. The other thing is, the actual way this is going to be financed is probably going to be through loans, and because the government in the end are going to be liable. So those loans are going to be pushed through by the banks. And this comes down, you know, it's all this, the new kind of capitalism, which I think everyone needs to be aware of, this financial capitalism. Because the growth of debt, you know, that's where capitalism is going. And this wasn't foreseen by Marx back in the 19th century. But this type of growth of debt and lending money to people and governments that can't afford to pay is all about what's happening at the moment, and that's relatively new. Well, it's been going on for a few years, but of the last 10 years, it's grown massively. And that's something I think we need to be aware of. Okay.
Can I just comment on Nick's thing briefly, please, before I go?
Please do.
Very briefly, Nick. I mean, I don't know. My experience of tax is that I've never actually had it. It's not as if I've had that money and I've been allowed to make a choice of how I spend it. It's, you get a wage, but you never get that money, so-called tax, that you're alleged to have paid. I've never had it. It's not as if it's something that I think, oh, I've got that, how shall I now pay for that? I have no choice in the matter. It was always deducted long before I ever got it. And even if I got it, you know, you'd end up in prison if you didn't immediately give it back. So I'm not quite sure about that tax thing. I'm not sure I agree it's taxpayers. I think I've never had that money.
Yeah, I mean, this has opened an issue that's quite interesting. but slightly aside. I think the issue is that we as workers produce all that exists in the country, and the this argument about taxes is slight. It's interesting, but I think it's not going to be. I think we shouldn't go down that for the moment because it's quite complicated. But I'm sorry. I didn't mean to squash discussion on. I just think that let me take the next question. Raymond Armstrong.
Steve, you keep going faint again.
Sorry, it's because my microphone's crap. I'll take Raymond Armstrong. Got the cue.
Thank you. It's a question that doesn't really apply to this talk, I suppose. It was about this Adam Curtis documentary. I watched the entire 8-hour epic last night, and I thought it might be a good topic of discussion maybe in a future meeting. So I'll just leave it at that because I know it's not really related to the talk tonight. Cheers.
Okay, let us have the details and we'll see about that. Okay. Have we got anybody that wants to make any contributions? We've got a lot of comments in the speaking queue, but nobody wants to ask a question on. Well, comrades, it's 9:30. Unless anybody wants to say something urgently, I've got Freddie typing. Is it going to be a question, Freddie? unless anybody's got anything.
No, you're okay, Steve. I've no more to say.
Okay. Okay. Well, I see from the DMs that direct messages that Comrade Morris has had to bugger off. So unless we've got any other we've got Nick, if you want to come back in then, Nick, please do.
Just the last thing to say about tax. I mean, yeah, in the end everyone pays for tax because, you know, if government have to raise taxes, even if you're in the pleasant position that you don't pay tax due to what you earn, the government is forced to finance these projects. So the only way they can do that is by reducing the size of the welfare state. So everyone in the end will pay. So, yeah, I mean, increasing contributions from tax will affect everyone. It's not something that's just directed purely at the middle classes. It's all the working people, the non-elite are going to end up paying. That's the point.
Okay, thank you, Nate. Thanks very much. Okay, well, given the time, I'd like to thank you. Oh, thanks, Raymond. Given the time, I'd like to thank you all for your attendance on your buggered off. Thanks to Comrade Glenn. Yeah, hopefully we'll speak to you next week. Keep looking at the stand party website. Thank you very much. Good night and take care.
Thank you and good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
Cheers, Margie. Cheers, Janet.